Welcome to Crime Corner, where we examine all things crime, whether it be on the page, on the screen, on the street, or in the courtroom. I don't know about that music I have to start the show. I love it, but it works in pre-show, but it's always late when the show starts. Anyway, thanks for hanging in there. I'm Matt Coyle, author of the Rick Cahill Crime Series, and I'll be your host for as long as it takes. Although, actually, tonight I won't be your host because I'm going to be the interviewee. And my guest host tonight, Jeff Dossett, has over 20 years of sports radio broadcasting experience, having hosted shows in the premium morning and afternoon drive time slot for multiple San Diego and Los Angeles stations, as well as College Football Saturdays, which was a great show, heard nationally on Fox Sports Radio. Jeff developed and hosted Clinch Gear Radio for Sirius XM and the Armed Radio Forces Network. He's involved with numerous charities, including the Alpha Project, Rancho Coastal Humane Society, and the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. He's also on the board for the local chapter of USA Boxing. In addition, he co-hosts a great podcast called The Dave and Jeff Show. And he lives in San Diego with his sons, Cade and Jack. Welcome, Jeff Dotseth.
Hello, Matt. I appreciate you having me. I'm a big fan. And what I always say to people when I preface how much I enjoy the Rick Cahill story in the series is how we met. And I was doing mornings on San Diego radio, and you sent me a message on Twitter. And you sent me a message on social media saying that whatever the story of the day was, I took it in a direction that you weren't expecting. Your name was new for me, so as I always do with the curiosity factor, I went and looked you up. And when I found that you were a mystery writer, I'm a guy who loves good mysteries. So I said, I remember writing you back, and I said, hey, if I'm able to fool a mystery writer, I must be doing my job. At which point you said, hey, would you like a copy of my book, Yesterday's Echo? And I said, absolutely. So you were nice enough to bring Yesterday's Echo over to the studio, and I had a great time chatting with you for a few minutes. And that book, Yesterday's Echo, promptly went into my back seat where it sat for about 4 weeks. After 4 weeks, you contacted me, and you said, hey, what'd you think of the book? And having not even cracked the cover, I said, man, it's fantastic. And you said, would you like a copy of book two? I said, yes, that would be great. I'm looking forward to it. And I immediately went in a complete panic and said to Dave Palais, who I work with, I haven't read this book. I don't know what to do. He's coming back tomorrow with book two. Well, the funny thing was that night I went home and I read probably I had to prepare for the radio show, so by the time that got done, it was close to 11 o'clock at night. Again, my show started at 6 o'clock in the morning.
That's right.
And at 11 o'clock at night till probably 1:30 in the morning, I read about 225 pages of Yesterday's Echo. And I remember when you came in, I was like, hey, this is great. And you had this look like, I think you said that before. And as the great boxing promoter Bob Arum used to say, yesterday I was lying, today I'm telling the truth. So I have I've been a fan the whole time. I've read every one of the books, and this is book five for Rick Cahill. We'll start this way. What's he been up to, and what do you think the biggest change has been, both positive and negative, since the last time we chatted with him?
Well, yeah, this is book five, Wrong Light. Actually, book four, let me see, what's it called? Blood Truth. It answered some questions that readers all along have wondered about regarding his father. So it was kind of cathartic, not only Rick, but for me in writing it. So finally, something was tied up, because there's generally in the books that I have, for good or bad, there's some baggage that hangs over. There's a little story that possibly hangs over that needs to be resolved at some time, and I wanted to wrap up the father's arc with Blood Truth. So with that, Rick is a little bit in a different position where he's a little more positive about life, perhaps, when he takes this case of a woman named Naomi Hendricks, who is a talk radio star on a station that has never had one before. She gets you know, five times the ratings that anybody else in the show does. And she's being menaced by a character who calls himself Pluto. He's written her a kind of a nasty letter, has left her voicemail messages, and the radio station initially goes to the police. The police thinks, well, there's not really enough there for us to do anything. So they hire Rick to try to find out who this guy is, give Nomi some protection, and track him down. And ironically, I got the idea for the way the envelope is written. The envelope and the letter is written in really hard pressed handwriting, which I got from you, from an actual story that happened to you or someone you knew in the talk radio business, where you got a creepy letter.
It happened to me. It happened to me. And to me, I've always found radio fascinating, Matt, and it's probably because I lived it, but we haven't seen many books or movies that have covered the relationship between radio host, listener/caller. What was it about that world that drew you to talk radio for Naomi Hendricks and Ron White?
Well, I used to listen to, I've listened to, obviously, sports talk radio for many years. I've listened to political talk radio. But back in the day, way back, there used to be a guy named Bill Balance in San Diego. You remember Bill Balance in San Diego?
I worked with him.
There you go. And he would, and Dr. Laura, before she kind of got out there, and it was a different deal. Talk radio then was kind of a different thing. It was more kind of it wasn't bellicose like much of it is now. It was sort of a soothing thing, or my recollection at least, and who knows if I can remember what really happened back then, but it's been a long time. So I like the idea. What if we have this we modernize, we have this modern woman who's kind of doing this old school talk radio where people call in with their problems and she sues them and she gives them some ideas, and beyond that, she's kind of she's mysterious and sexy, and definitely with a very sexy voice. And so I thought, why not have that? Because I have been a talk radio fan for somebody's calling me. I have been a talk radio fan for, I don't know, 30 years probably. So I wanted to get in there, but I wanted to do it kind of as a throwback.
I'm glad you chose nighttime, because I'll tell people this. I've said that if I ever went back, and I've been lucky enough in a 20-plus year career to do pretty much every shift on the clock, morning drive, afternoon drive, middays, and night. And for me, nighttime talk radio is the last real radio. Everything else is controlled by corporate, by sponsors. Arguments that you hear, whether you're watching on TV, it could be Stephen A. Smith and Max Kellerman. It could be CNN with Don Lemon. It's all preconceived. It's all somebody's going to go in and be the good guy and somebody's going to be the bad guy. And it's basically glorified WWE in a nicer suit. What I love about what you captured with Nighttime Talk Radio is it's raw and it's real. It's the relationship between the host, in this case, Naomi, and her audience.
Right.
And when you talked about that letter, that happened to me. That happened to me when I was doing nighttime radio. I went and got a letter, and it was written to me, and it was on small kind of think like hotel-style stationery, where it's small and not very wide and long, and it was 8 pages, 4 pages front and back, and it was written so heavy in ballpoint pen that it pushed through to the other side. And it was like there was a part of it, I'll tell people, this is the funny thing, because Matt, you and I chatted, and this is no spoiler, I remember when you and I were chatting about that story, and you said, what was the reaction? And to me, it's not false bravado. I just kind of felt like I didn't feel fear at all. I didn't feel like I was in any kind of danger. Our program director immediately freaked out. But the best part of this was there was a sense of jealousy that you felt amongst the other people on the air that wondered, why did he get a letter and we didn't? That's how screwed up radio people are. And I think there's an interesting parallel between who Naomi is and who Rick is. And I was wondering, Matt, if we asked Naomi and Rick together, would they say they're similar or different? And how so?
That's a good question. I think they're similar in one way, in that they're both, they're somewhat secretive. Of course, it may not seem that way because you're in Rick's head the whole time when you're reading, but he doesn't really give that much to the outside world. They both have somewhat of a dark past, although we don't really know what Naomi's is for some time. And they're both loners. So, yeah, I think they're similar. I think that, I'll just say that, they're both loners.
Yeah,
I,
think you're right. I think you're right. And I think that's it, because, you know, I'll ask it more on Rick than I will Naomi, because we know Rick and you know Rick. Is Rick driven more by a fear of failure, or could he be driven by a fear of success at the same time?
He's driven by, I guess you could tie it into the fear of failure, because his whole life is now, since his wife was murdered and he feels responsible, now it's been, when this book comes out, 13 years, I think. Mm-hmm. He feels responsible for her death, and whether she did it or not, you can read yesterday's Echo and find out, the first book. But, so his whole life is a quest for redemption, and it gets, with each book, I think it gets a little more, he's a little more driven, and a little more manic. So it's, there is some, you could tie that into fear of failure, but it's really this quest for redemption, as well as finding the truth of the matter. And I think if someone was looking at Rick from the outside, they would say, hey, you're good. You've got the redemption. I mean, you've made some decisions that people have gotten hurt, but your heart is in the right place. You've helped people. You've tried to do the right thing. You're redeemed, but he doesn't feel that way. And I don't know if he ever will.
It's funny, and it kind of leads into what I was going to ask you next, because I've seen you mention at a couple of different book signings that you're not always sure if the audience likes Rick. So I'll start this way. Do you like him? And if so, what would make you question whether or not the reader does at the same time?
Yeah, I like him. I understand him to a degree. I've been writing him for 16 years. It took me 10 years to get published. 10 or 11 years. I like him a lot, but I understand. I think that the goal obviously is when you write each book is you want it to be I'm writing a series, but you want it to be a standalone where people can pick it up and not miss anything or not feel like they missed anything from earlier things. It's a delicate balance to get that. And every time I get a review that says it works as a standalone, I'm very happy. But people that come in late, perhaps, will not know exactly why Rick makes some of the decisions he does. And even though some of it's touched upon and retouched upon, this manic drive for redemption and some of the decisions he makes because of it. So I like him, but I'm not, but when I mentioned that at the talk you were at, I think I was specifically thinking about the book I'm writing right now where, Rick is really—he's really out there. There's a quest, and he has a chance. He has a chance to actually finish this quest for him, and he's really making some difficult decisions, and just completely driven. That, and with each new book, each new quest, he is more determined, and so he takes shortcuts. And sometimes he doesn't take people's feelings into consideration. He may feel guilty about it later, but this is A to B. You're in between me and B. I have to go through you, and if you can help me, great. If you can't, get the hell out of the way. So that's my concern with Rick and people liking him. But I have a pretty really fantastic base of followers who like Rick for all of his faults. So so far I'm doing it okay, I think.
Yeah, I like him a lot. That's why it's funny. I like him. I feel like his personality, the rough edges, are what makes him good at what he does. And probably what I mean by that is good at what he does as far as being a compelling character in a book more than being a private investigator. And I feel like he's been that way in yesterday's Echo, Night Tremors, Dark Fisher's, Blood Truth. And people will find out for themselves in wrong light. I'm going to ask you to try to answer this more kind of based on books 1 through 4 and into five and try to keep out what you're working as far as book six. We can do this again in a year. But as we are today with working into book five, would you say that one storyline that is a common thread that goes through every one of these books is the death of his father and the death of his wife? And I'm wondering which one of those haunts him more. Is it the ghost of his father, or is it that of his ex-wife? Or his wife?
It's his wife. His wife, because yeah. He feels responsible. Although his father was very important too, because this was a guy that he idolized as a kid. His father was a police officer. In fact, he was a well-respected police officer. And Rick idolized him. And then there was a falling out with the police department. He was thought to be dirty, his father. And he got kicked off the force, and he shrunk down as a man. He shrunk down as a father. He shrunk down as a husband and became an alcoholic. And Rick grew to despise him and have no respect for him. And after he's gone, that haunts Rick as well. But there is some resolution, I will say, in Blood Truth for that. But definitely it's his wife, Colleen, the death of Colleen. That's his quest to redeem himself somehow for his failure with her, his perceived failure. He's pretty hard on himself.
Yeah, he definitely is. And one of the things that I'm fascinated by, and with this book being about talk radio, is the biggest misconception, I believe, about talk radio or people that work in radio is that the host gets away with only working 3 hours a day. That's what people would say all the time. Oh, man, what time's your show? 6 to 9. Oh, man, you're done at 9 o'clock. Well, it's a complete joke. Because as a radio host, you never really turn it off. You're always looking for storylines. You're always looking for angles. You're trying to do everything. You talked about the fact that you've been writing Rick now for such a period of time. How easy is it for you to get away from Cahill? And could that closeness that you have with the character play any role in Rick getting a little darker as we move into book five and eventually into book six?
Yeah, I think at some point I'm going to have to write something different. I don't ever want to stop writing Rick, but I think just for growth and for economic reasons, I want to start writing standalone at some point fairly soon or a new series. But as I said, I can't imagine not writing Rick. He's in my blood. But yeah, I just see I see all the damage he's taken over the years. Physically, he's taken a lot, but mentally, much more, and some of it's self-inflicted. So when I'm writing him, I try to think about, I always have that as a consideration of what's happened to him up now. What scars does he have? And this is going to inform his decisions. I don't think he can get away with that. I think we are our past, or certainly whether we are or not, Rick Cahill is. He's his past. So all these things they pile up and they inform his decisions, and it has taken him on a darker turn. I believe he's still a good man. I believe he's got a good heart, but he's definitely gotten darker and a little harsher. I think he would have to, unless he was a perfect man. He's not a perfect man. So I had a reviewer one time ask me, he said, I think in a review or just something he emailed me, he said, I think Rick's a bit of a philosopher. I hadn't really thought about it, but then once he said that, I think, well, I think you're right, because if he didn't think about these things, internalize them some way and give them thought, I think if he was able just to ignore all of his actions, I think he'd be a real dangerous guy and a real, really bad guy. But I still think he's a good guy.
Yeah, I like them. You talked about the books being standalones. What I tell everybody is read them in order, because I feel like if you read them in order, you see character development. Then not only do you see it with Cahill, but you see it with two familiar names that are back in wrong light. And the first is Peter Stone. How would you describe the relationship between Peter Stone and Rick Cahill?
Adversarial. but there's been times where they've had mutual goals in some ways, and they've had to work together. But ultimately, as it develops, I think there's a little bit of a father-son deal going on there. really, a really twisted way. But I think what the thing about Stone is, he's a former casino boss from Vegas. Obviously a little dirty, but he's reinvented himself. When he lives in La Jolla, he lives in like a $15 million home up above the ocean. He's reinvented himself as kind of a philanthropist. He's a real estate developer, and he gives money, and he puts his name on buildings and stuff. So people that don't know his background or don't really want to believe it think he's a good guy. And Rick, from an earlier book, the first book, actually, Zeko, Rick knew very soon that Rick, that Stone is not a good guy. And but God, I had a good point. I can't remember what the hell it was.
Stone
he's used to having things go his own way, and he's used to being in control. Yeah. He's used to having people do what he says, his little minions, what have you. And Rick, at times they've had to work together. Rick talks back, Rick challenges him, and Stone actually likes that. He doesn't want that yet. He doesn't always want a yes man near him. He kind of likes somebody's got some gumption, or what was it that Lou Grant said to Mary Tyler Moore? Can't remember what that was.
Spunk.
You got spunk. But actually, whereas Lou did not like spunk, I think Stone does like spunker. Yeah. Anyway,
yeah, my
so
follow-up on that, will be, as somebody who's read it, you write it. I feel like Stone may like Cahill more than Cahill likes Stone. However, taking the money and the success aside, there's a part of me when I read these two that I feel like Rick may want to be more like Stone than Stone has any interest in being like Cahill. And I'm just wondering if you feel like there's any truth to that. I just feel like, again, taking the success, that's the easy way. But if it's just mano-a-mano, I kind of feel like there's a part of Cahill where he wishes he ran his life in a manner more like Stone runs his, maybe a little bit more structured, as maybe opposed to a little bit more seat of the pants. Any truth to it?
I think that's a good call. And you said something really interesting I hadn't thought about, but it's absolutely true, is that Stone does like Rick. And he definitely – Rick has a grudging respect for Stone, doesn't like him, but Stone does like Rick. But in his very twisted way. But I think that Rick Stone is not an emotional guy. There are times when he gets angry, but he seals it up pretty quickly. And Rick does go by his emotions too much, and that can get him into trouble. And I do think he definitely, I think, respects Stone, not what he does, but maybe the way he handles himself in doing it.
I hope the relationship continues, because there's something when he comes in the book that I don't really know. Maybe it's a funny analogy, but it's just the first one that pops in my head. It's when you watch Seinfeld and Kramer would come into the room, you knew something was going to happen. They couldn't be more opposite, Peter Stone and Cosmo Kramer. But when Peter Stone comes on the page, you know it's not going to be boring. So I hope he sticks around. Another character who's back is Moira. And for people that may not have read your previous books, describe her role. And the follow-up on that, Matt, is I have a feeling she may be, out of the names that I've talked about, maybe the most fun to write. Talk about Moira, her relationship to Cahill. I combined you guys, and how she plays an impact in Wrong Light.
Yeah, that's a pretty good analysis. She came in the second book, Night Tremors, and I needed a private investigator to sort of help out on the case. She ends up kind of unknowingly bigfooting her out of a case she was initially on. They chose Rick over her, and she's upset with him. Comes to his house, knocks on his door. She's 5 feet tall, 90 pounds of like a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar size attitude. And she's a better private eye than Rick is. She's smarter than his. She's less emotional than he is. So they have a combative bit of a relationship in that book. And then in the third book, they're all two-word books. I forget what they're called. Dark Fishers.
Yeah.
Which is he need she's he where the hell is she in that book? I can't remember. She's only they sort of have developed this relationship where she has kind of brought him under her wing in a friendship, kind of a sister, I don't like this punk kid, but he needs my help relationship. And he just called her on the phone for information. He can't get any information from the cops because all the cops hate him. So if she can get some information that he'll be able to use in a case, he calls her. So she's in like two phone calls in the third book. For Blood Truth, I was going to use her for one scene. I needed her one scene. I put her in there. She's in the scene. She says something. I go, wait a second. And she ended up being in the book throughout in Blood Truth, became the conscience of the book. And that relationship I had to bring into Wrong Light. And once again, she's helping Rick at the detriment of her own career in some ways and safety in some ways. But she likes this guy, and he loves her. He loves her as a sister, and she probably loves him too. But he frustrates her, and she's the guidance that he needs. She's the fourth side that Rick doesn't have. He's got three sides, and she's that extra calm that he needs and intelligence. And he says frequently throughout the books that she's the best PI in San Diego, and he doesn't know why that he gets cases and they should all go to her.
Well, then he walks me right in to what I was going to ask about her, because when I read about her, I think John Sanford, Virgil Flowers, I think Michael Conley, Mickey Haller, both series that started off with characters that became famous as sidekicks. Could Moira carry her own series?
I think she could. There's financial considerations, is all I'll say about that. Whether to do that with her, maybe somewhere down the line. Actually, the book that I'm writing now was going to be more of a Moira book, but it ended up being a direction I had to go for Rick to find the truth out about his wife. But yeah, I would love to. You in your initial question, you said, I'll bet she's the funnest one to write, and she definitely was.
Yeah.
In Blood Truth, I love writing her. In Blood Truth, like I said, I didn't know her that well. She'd only been in a couple books, and she just blossomed on the scene. She was exactly what Rick needed, exactly what the book needed, kind of a conscience, I think I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And she's a part of Rick. She's important. She's Rick's best friend, and he doesn't have many friends. But like I said, she's a guiding influence as well that he doesn't take her advice enough. But yeah, okay, I would love to write. I was thinking about doing maybe her in third person and Rick in first person. So that's a possibility, or just having her have her own gig.
I'm going to bounce around to something I was going to bring up later, but you just mentioned that she is Rick's friend and he doesn't have many friends. What happened to Turk? You seem like a character that we looked at that could kind of call Cahill on his BS. Hasn't been seen from, heard from in a long time. But one of those guys that you felt like he knew the flip side of the trading card that a lot of us don't know. Do we see Turk back again? And if not, how come?
I don't know. I intended to write Turk a little bit more. He's in a very short scene in Blood Truth. Because they had a falling out, and they haven't recovered. Although he does allow Rick to use his restaurant basically as Rick's office. Yeah, he'll give him
like
he'll let him have a booth.
Do, right?
Yeah, but it's brothers that haven't really made up yet. And because Turk wasn't, I love Turk, and he's an important character to me because of who he represents in my real life.
Sure.
But he was doing some things that were questionable as well. But they haven't made all the way up. And I've intended to have him come back, but sometimes the story just kind of goes in the direction that it has to go.
Well, you know, and saying that, Matt, there's bringing it back to talk radio, there's a science to talk radio. You don't just go in, turn the mic on, and turn it loose. Anybody who does that is going to be dead quickly. You have to find a way to do the same topic that others are covering, but you got to find a way to do it and be interesting and compelling. You can also be a little over the top if needed. So if that's the science for talk radio, what's the science to writing mysteries? Because one of the things that, going back to Moira, the natural thing would be, well, they're going to hang around in these books and then they're going to be romantically involved, and they haven't. They've lived their parallel lives, tension, anger, but ultimately work together as a team. From what you've learned in getting 6 books published, what's the science to writing mysteries?
I wish I could tell you. There are people that know. There are people that are a lot more organized than I am, who outline extensively. For me, it's...
What's been the science for you?
Well, for me, it's character. It's always character. It's how does the crime reveal character? And, of course, when you have murder, that's the ultimate crime, and that affects more people than probably any other crime. It affects the family of the deceased. Obviously, it affects the deceased. It affects the investigators who are investigating murder, and it affects the murderer. This is something that maybe they've done a lot, maybe they haven't, but there's going to be some reverberations for them as well. So I look for an inciting incident, or I can take my guy, Rick Cahill, and have him be involved in something where it may not always start that he's got some emotional connection to it, but he ends up with an emotional connection to the case, which at times clouds things for him, and it doesn't make it a straight ahead mystery or thriller or police procedural at all. So there's some zigzags because of because of how he's affected by what goes on. And that may be another person. That may be a woman. It may be something from his past. It may be someone from his past. But that's, for me, that's it. And obviously the crime is the inciting, or generally is the inciting incident. So how does that affect people? How does he make decisions regarding the choices he makes? And so then I need to just, I have an idea what the end's going to be, but I have to get Rick there. But it has to be from decisions that make sense, that make sense for him. Maybe not the best decisions, but maybe someone smarter or less emotional will make a different decision. But I have to make it true to his character. So how, as I'm plotting my way through to get to the end, I have to follow Rick's true character to get there. And so for me, that's the most important thing. I think most mystery writers think in terms of character first. Maybe there's some thriller writers think more in terms of plot, but I think most mystery writers really think character first. And for me, that, and I've got this horrible, I've talked about it before, this horrible organics writing method, and I just learned to trust it, and I don't really worry about it too much anymore.
Are you able to read? You and I have talked about guys that you enjoy, whether it's Robert Crace or Jeff Parker or others. Is it a challenge for you to read books with no fear that an idea will seep its way into your brain and inadvertently show up in book 7?
Well, maybe stuff has shown up, but I have no qualms about reading the genre while I'm writing it. That's what I've read all my life. So that's I read nonfiction as well, but if I'm reading fiction, I'm going to read crime. And so I may learn something. So when I'm reading Michael Connelly, I will learn things about police procedurals that I'm not going to steal something from him, but I've learned something. It's just because generally he used to be a crime reporter, and he's got ins with LAPD. So I'm not going to steal some cool idea he had, but some of the stuff he has in there, oh, that's how they do it. Now, I have a friend, David Putnam, who's a former sheriff's deputy, who gives me stuff all the time, you know, real stuff. But there's Connelly, there's always something in there. I mean, every Connelly book I have is dog-eared because of, oh, I didn't know that's how it worked. So that kind of thing, but you know, I don't steal ideas. But of course, I think you absorb everyone you've ever read. So that may come out in style some way that you don't know about, but it's nothing that I think about. But I love crime. My biggest bummer is when I can't read because I've got so many things to do. I try to read crime every day. Love it. But also you are learning craft too. When you're reading great writers, you're learning craft, and so you're definitely, oh, how did he do that? Oh, I see how he did that. So you are learning that way too, and I don't think that's stealing. That's just getting educated.
You know what's funny, and why I mention it is that I have friends in sports talk radio, And we used to say all the time to each other, like the nicest compliment that we could give each other is, hey, I heard you had a great show. You know, I didn't listen to it because I didn't want to steal anything. And we would always laugh because you were always afraid that whatever, you know, Matt Coyle's angle was on that Tom Brady play, that it was going to work its way into your show and you were no longer giving your own original thought on it. You were just changing the wording on Matt's. So if you didn't listen to Matt's show, then whatever ideas you presented in your neurotic world as a talk radio host, you could walk away feeling like, yeah, it was mine. Even though we could both say, hey, today's Friday and tomorrow's Saturday, as long as I didn't hear you say it 30 minutes before I went on the air, then it was my original idea. It's how, and let me ask you this, and this will wrap it up for you. Writing Wrong Light, which I think you nailed it. I was really, really happy. I was really concerned that I gave you poor information regarding talk radio, but reading it, I felt like you nailed it. A couple of different things for me. A, what you learned about the world of talk radio writing this book, and also, more importantly, what you learned about Rick Cahill writing this book?
Well, I think I think I was kind of lucky in my general assumption of what a the term wrong now because I can't even remember what I wrote last time, but the guy who kind of runs the show is
program director
yeah. Exactly. See, I can't remember, just that they kind of all be a little bit neurotic and worried about their careers. And from information I got from an inside guy, I think I was kind of spot on with that. But being fortunate enough to you actually had brought me to your studio, the old studio, a couple times, so I got a little insight there, just how kind of things work. But in terms of learning about Rick, just that the boundaries are moving for him, or he's moving outside them, and he's having a hard time with that, and he's coming to a point in his life where he needs to have some serious thoughts about it. He has to have some serious thoughts about it if he can continue to be a private investigator, because he tries to help a lot of times, and sometimes bad things happen. Now, they may have happened if he wasn't on the case, but sometimes he thinks that if he'd made a different decision, maybe something bad hadn't happened. And so he's had so many cases where there has been some people, well, not so many cases, but there've been people have died and people have been hurt. And he wonders if he's responsible, how much longer can he do this? And if he does continue to do it, will he be too hard about it? If that makes any sense.
I think so. What I'm excited about is January 31st, you and I will be at the Book Catapult in San Diego talking about it. You know, for me, Matt, the thing is, starting as a kid, I have always enjoyed reading. And it was funny. I started with, it was always biographies. There was nothing really fiction. One of my favorite books that I ever read was the biography of autobiography written by Jack Dempsey. And Jack Dempsey told this story that as he was a kid and he was learning to be a fighter, one of his early coaches made him chew gum that was made out of rosin and how it would strengthen his jaw. And you just think about what a different life it was when these guys were basically fighting in like dress gloves. And so you would read all these stories and people would say, you know, why don't you read fiction? I said, because sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, stronger than fiction. But then at a certain point, people turned me on to Grisham, turned me on to John Sanford, turned me on to Don Winslow, Steve Hamilton, all of those guys. I will say this. I've said this sincerely. I couldn't be more excited that you sent me that tweet that day that started it. That's why I get such a kick out of sharing that story, because I have enjoyed every one of the five books. And just to be able to give you a little bit of background for the radio side, for Naomi, what life may have been like, personalities, who she could be dealing with, I'm telling you, I've met a lot of people. I've gone a lot of places. It's one of the coolest things that I've ever been a part of. So I can't thank you enough for doing it. I think the book's fantastic. I think they get better with each one. Now, that's an unbiased opinion because I helped on this one. And I think it's fascinating to see where Cahill goes next. And if he's getting a little bit of a dark side, let him get it, man. Let him get it. The readers are enjoying it and ready to go along for the ride.
Well, I appreciate it, man. As I've stated in the book, the acknowledgments, how much I appreciate what you, the insight you gave me. And but beyond that, all the, you know, because when I sent you that book, there was some self-servingness in there, right?
I was fine with it.
You gave me some occasional shout-outs where I've actually been able to have some sports talk radio listeners read my books now, which is really cool. I appreciate it.
Hey, you know, well, I'll say this. Everybody I've turned on to the books, and I always tell them, the website is mattcoylebooks.com. I'll hype your own website. I'm happy to do it. I've done it for 20 years. Start with Yesterday's Echo. I know they could all be read as standalones, but for me, I always say learn who Rick is. Learn that relationship with Turk and Peter Stone and the others that come into his life, because then when you pick up Book 2 and Dark Fishers and you pick up Night Tremors and Blood Truth and eventually you'll get to Wrong Light, you're going to know who all these people are. You go, oh, that's familiar. I know what Stone's all about. I still visualize him, I told you, like the actor William Devane. I can see William Devane when I see Peter Stone. There was a girl who worked at a coffee shop up here in Carlsbad. I told her, I said, you're Moira. She's like, what? Yeah. I don't know what that means. I said, go read these books. And she goes, she did. She loved them. So continued success to you, my friend. Wrong Light is dynamite. And I hope it sells lots and lots of copies, and there's a lot more Rick Cahill stories down the line.
Well, I appreciate it, Jeff. And by the way, it's the DaveAndJeffShow.com for a really cool podcast. Not only sports, some topical stuff, and you will laugh for sure. All right, man,
and,
I appreciate
you'll
it.
Be on that, you'll be on that show first part of January, so we look forward to having you in.
Cool. Can't wait.
All right,
thanks,
Matt.
Man.
Continued success. Thank you.
Buddy. All right, so that is actually going to be the last show of 2018. I want to thank everybody for listening. I know it's been a little inconsistent with my supposed two-week schedule because of the fact that I'm leaving my day job or left my day job today to write full-time. I will have more time to dig into shows and hope to be really more consistent in 2019. So just follow me on Facebook when you'll see the next show in January. I'm not sure. I am doing a kind of boosting the tour in January for Wrong Light. So I'm not exactly sure when we'll do it again. But I do appreciate everybody listening for 2018. And I will talk to you again in 2019. This is a copyrighted broadcast solely owned by the author on the air. Global.